Pantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Rain of Fire by Ralph Kern, narrated by Jeffrey Kafer. Chapter 1. Colonel Tor Hest, Galton Orbit. The glowing red digits of the timer projected on the cockpit heads-up display counted inexorably down. This is happening. This is really happening. Colonel Arya Tor Hest tried to focus on the task at hand, running through pre-jump checks, ensuring her lance was ready, preparing for the brutal business to come. And she failed. It was only training which guided her hands on the controls, even as she looked through the scratched, pitted cockpit window, past the swarms of gentle, twinkling ships and jump mechs hanging in orbit over the dawning hemisphere of a pristine world. She wanted to capture in her mind, to look at, to really look at, her world, Galton, the capital of the Neo-Hegemony. Maybe for the last time. Just on the Terminator line where night turned today lay the peninsula of Harriet Province. Her family's estate sat in a meadow, a short distance from the cliff-lined coast. There her children would be waking to a new dawn, both real and metaphorical. She sought to etch a picture of her once beautiful land in her mind, the land which generations of her family had toiled over. Deep green tracts of lush forest surrounded the rough-cut stone of her manor, while beyond, the vibrant blue Leston Ocean bordered the peninsula. A small village, quaint in appearance, where her retainers lived nestled in a valley inland down a winding country road. But also from her elevated position in orbit, she saw the brutal craters and blemishes still unrepaired from the last war, the Great War, marring the land. The war, the now-dead Galton Imperium had lost so badly. The reason why she and millions of others had heeded this new call to action, united under a new banner and with a new cause. A cause irresistible in its clarion call, especially to the youth. To take revenge, to take back their honor, to finish what their parents had started, and to take their rightful destiny. Her console chimed and the stern, scarred face of Field Marshal Richter Galen appeared on the HUD, obliterating the view of her home, bringing her musing to a crashing halt. All units of Army Group Alpha, Rain Fire Phase 2 is a go. The Marshal paused. For dramatic effect or through nervousness at what he was about to unleash, Hest didn't know. But the pause didn't last long. In Father Terra's name, execute. Hest pressed her head back against the leather headrest. She took a deep breath in, even as before her came a dizzying ripple of flashes. Dozens, hundreds, then thousands of bursts of red light washed over Galton. So many it would turn the night side of the world to a hellish day. A brightness grew within the cockpit, its intensity turning the world before her to monochrome. Then even that was obliterated by the fierce light. The blinding brightness disappeared as if a switch had been thrown. Galton had been replaced. She found herself hovering over another planet, the Aurelian Republic world of Asteria, in the Tweena system, her jump drive tuned to bring her to a suborbital velocity. Glistening spiderwebs of cities crossed the night side, already turned to blurred orange as flames tore across them from the aerospace core's softening attack in Rainfire Phase 1. She craned her neck up. The number of stations and ships in Asteria's orbit was so dense as to be visible to the naked eye. And directly above her loomed the nearest of the Republic's massive fortresses, huge weapon-encrusted asteroids hauled into the world's orbit a decade before. But it wasn't a serene vision. Streamers of weapons fire lashed across the vista. The Republicans were good. They hadn't hesitated. They had responded decisively to the swarms of hegemony fighters tearing through them and the hordes of jump mechs appearing in their vicinity. They may not have hesitated, but they hadn't responded effectively. The huge cannons and myriad weapons of the orbital fortresses were designed to ward off a conventional assault, to deal with fleets led by capital ships spiraling into orbit from above, not hundreds of fighters striking at them from below. And definitely not thousands of jump mechs screaming down to the surface of the world they hung over. No, the aerospace corps, the fighter and bomber arm of the hegemony's military, couldn't fight the Republic on their terms. So Galton had changed those terms to ones they could win. The gently curved line of the horizon crept up the cockpit window as her mech fell from orbit, the fires from re-entry already flickering up the war machine's hull. She felt the buffeting of entry as she hit the atmosphere proper. Spread across her vision, she could see thousands of fiery streaks plummeting with her. Her jump mech rocked as a squadron of S-91 Wolf Space Superiority fighters blurred past vertically down, the agile craft plummeting to the surface ahead of her invasion force, leaving a trail of turbulence. Anti-airspace fire opened up from the surface. Wispy spirals of missiles, ineffective against the agile fighters' electronic warfare suites, were deadly against the vulnerable mechs. Flak blossomed all around her. Streamers of pulse fire arced across the sky, both from above and below. The clouds of descending jump mechs were riddled with a staccato of explosions. Hest felt herself being thrust back and forth within the tight confines of her cockpit, knowing death could come at any time with no more warning than seeing her mech disintegrate around her, leaving her to fall screaming to the surface. One of her platoon mates exploded next to her as a missile slammed into the falling mech, turning it into a shower of debris tumbling alongside her. She gritted her teeth, her fear turning to anger at the loss. Another son or daughter of Galton dead, along with many others, before they'd even truly engage the enemy. She forced down the anguish at the loss. Now was not the time to mourn. Hest glanced at the altimeter as she punched through a misty layer of stratus cloud. 100,000 feet. Close enough. AA fire is heavy. All mechs drop pods. She didn't wait for an acknowledgement. Instead, she reached up and flicked 4 switches. With a series of thuds, the drop pods released from the mech's back and plunged down alongside her amid a shower of chaff and flares, a probably vain attempt to ward off the fire seeking her out. All around, the radar returns multiplied as the others did the same. Thousands of mechs each loosed 4 drop pods containing a soldier. But even that impressive force would be a drop in the ocean against the resources of an entire world. Among the descending cloud of jump mechs and personnel drop pods, assault shuttles plunged down, adding thousands more troops to the fray. And far above, the heavy transports containing tens of thousands more soldiers would already be entering the system, perfectly synchronized for when a huge explosion illuminated the night side. One of the Republic's much-vaunted fortresses had been destroyed, leaving a gaping hole in Asteria's defensive coverage which the transports would wedge into. The altimeter spun down. More fighters surged past, the punished pilots likely redded out by the intense negative G they were subjected to as they plunged into the atmosphere. The vibration of her passage distorted her vision as her deceleration rockets fired, but even so, from the horizon, monstrous mushroom clouds bloomed into existence. Each one was a pyre on which thousands were dying. Hest winced at the thought of the vile nuclear weapons being used, but they were cheap and they were effective. And it was no more than what the Republic and the Kingdom had inflicted on the worlds and allies of the Galton Imperium all those years ago. She closed on the surface. Explosions stitched across fields and from clusters of buildings as she raced toward them. It was time she stopped being a passenger. Soon her work would begin. Her keen eye sought the small town, which was her immediate objective. With a thunderous burst of retro rockets, the jump mech slammed into the ground. A geyser of dirt erupted from the force of her impact. The 4 drop pods of her mounted infantry speared into the field next to Hest. She keyed a switch. The actuator braces tightened around her arms and legs, transferring her muscle movements into driving the mech's limbs. The mech, Hest, reflexively ducked as a lance of light appeared. A beamer anti-armor laser narrowly missed her. She stood from her crouch on the fire-blackened dirt, raising her arm and clenched her fist. Her pulse cannon fired. A withering hail of electric blue rounds riddled the building the beam had come from. Destruction scythed through it, turning the structure into a battered, collapsing shell. Something pinged off her armor. A brave, foolish soldier stood in the open, firing a rifle at her. Hest lifted her arm and fired again. The man disappeared, torn to pieces under the ferocity of her weapon. From all around him, other mechs and drop pods thudded into the ground, while above, fighters thundered over. And higher, the first of the huge civilian freighters converted into troop transports advanced into orbit. The invasion of the Aurelian Republic had begun. And the same was happening across the whole of the Arcadian sector. Chapter 2 Admiral Darrow, New Avalon, Admiralty House. Admiral Jonathan Darrow swept down the long corridor of Admiralty House, the heels of his gleaming black leather knee-length boots clicking on the veined marble floor. To either side, busts, hollow picks, and watercolors cluttered the wood panel walls, depicting battles from history and the leaders of yesteryear. 2 guards drew to attention as he approached the imposing double doors. He noted in satisfaction that the ceremonial red uniforms were gone, replaced by the dark gray of battle armor. Good, because one thing he'd garnered from the messages urgently pinging his comm was that now wasn't the time to be letting tradition dictate dress order. The soldiers snapped off perfect salutes as he drew close before turning to allow him to pass unimpeded. He nodded, then flicked an automatic salute in return as the deceptively sturdy doors rumbled open. They may have looked like mere wood, ornate and ancient, but it was a facade, hiding battle steel which could take a bunker buster bomb without bowing. Tapping his foot, he waited impatiently for the doors to open sufficiently for him to twist through. How the bloody hell had this happened? We moved the expeditionary force into the Republic precisely to stop this situation from arising. The bustle of officers filled the operations room beyond. In a stark contrast to the hallway, no expense had been spared in ensuring every facet was state-of-the-art, including the vast hologrammatic situation map, slowly rotating in the middle of the room. He gave a long exhalation as he took in what it showed. It made for depressing viewing. The green bulge of Republic space had red tendrils stretching through it from its neighboring star nation, the Galton Hegemony. No, Darrow corrected himself. The Neo-Hegemony now. Each of the red lines creeping forward was a Neo-Strike Force gaining more territory in a series of massive surprise assaults than they had taken at the Great War of 22 years ago. Admiral, a mug of steaming hot tea was thrust into his hand and he accepted it with a grunt. Something stronger might have been more welcome right now, given what he was seeing. He silently wished for the bottle of Silas No. 1 sitting in the bottom drawer of his desk as he watched the full-scale invasion of their strongest ally in the Arcadian sector. What do we have? He cast the whimsy aside as he addressed his head of intelligence. Captain Raul Martinez looked up from the console he stood over. His face glistened with perspiration, and it likely wasn't because of temperature in the fiercely air-conditioned room. So the Republicans have just been handed their asses on a plate. Darrow raised his eyebrow, allowing his expression to portray his disapproval at the staff officer's report. A few more facts and a little less rhetoric, if you please, Captain. The man pursed his lips. Not from the rebuke, Darrow wagered, but in having to articulate the horrendous scenario unfolding. New hegemony forces have entered the Republic, striking here, here, and here. Martinez gestured at three tendrils stretching through the holodisplay. Darrow cocked his head. The Republic's core systems of Aurelia, Asteria, and Ballery. The Admiral frowned. Each of those heavily populated worlds were guarded by the Republic's much-vaunted orbital fortresses, not that they looked to have slowed the hegemony forces down one single iota. Offshoots from the main advances spread wide, the enemy striking secondary targets. Initial reports suggest... Darrow flicked his eyes to look at the ashen captain. Suggest? Martinez continued undaunted, for the time being immune to Darrow's exacting standards of report. They will fall. Lost Earth, Darrow cursed. Those bloody fortresses, impenetrable to assault my arse. The sheer arrogance of the Republic in hedging their defenses on the huge things, which had now proven to be little more than exceptionally large and expensive bullseyes. How, Captain? Darrow asked slowly, processing furiously even as he spoke. How did this happen? Intel is sporadic, but so far it appears they direct-dropped at least a dozen mechanized divisions on each world with an indeterminate number of infantry, supported by aerospace fighters and bombers to gain superiority. And the fortresses themselves. Fortress Line Valianter over Asteria appears to have been completely destroyed. Again, intel is scarce, but if I were a betting man, I'd say the Republicans scuttled them to stop their seizure. And the others? Lines Defiant and Onerous over Aurelia and Ballery are at around 50% each. However, they appear to be offering minimal resistance now. They've either been taken, still fighting, or... Their COs didn't have the balls to push the button. Darrow massaged his clean-shaven cheek. A confusing emotion washed through him. There was disbelief at what he was looking at, of course. A supposedly hamstrung enemy had managed to take on the most significant and placed nation in the sector, and to all intents and purposes appear to be winning. And yes, there was a glimmer of admiration there, too. Neo-hegemony forces had managed it without naval support. Hell, they barely had a space-going navy worth a damn. The Treaty of Caris laid it out, a couple of capital ships which would barely be classed as more than heavy cruisers in any other navy, a handful of destroyers, and a few patrol craft. Though Admiral Darrow wasn't naive, it was a known fact the Galt had small shipyards producing minor vessels, most worryingly their damnable stealths, but nothing big. Frankly, it hadn't been worth the diplomatic headache to challenge them on it. Simply, they shouldn't be able to do this, to attack another nation, and certainly not one the size of the Republic. That was the whole damn point of the treaty. "So how the hell had they landed so many?" Darrow continued his thought aloud. In response, Martinez tapped on his tablet. The holodisplay swapped for what looked to be gun camera footage from some kind of military craft, perhaps a Republic fighter defending its home. Whoever it was didn't matter right that moment. The twilight horizon was visible as thousands of shooting stars rained down. The horizon tilted, and a box appeared around a comet screaming down toward the surface. A moment later, a line of tracer rounds lashed out toward it, riddling the already burning ember. An explosion bloomed even as the fighter banked around, then dived toward the ground where one of the objects had touched down. The footage froze and the image zoomed in. There, a patch of burning ground, and in the center, a mech, its gun already blazing at something out of view. "Intel has had..." Martinez lifted his arm, the black of his uniform sleeve drawing back, and glanced at an expensive silver watch. 32 minutes to come up with an estimate of just what happened here. "And... as best we can tell, it looks like each of the mechs have a sub-fighter mass jump drive and a re-entry pack," Martinez said. "They literally jumped them above the worlds and deorbited them directly onto the planet." An ember of admiration grew into a flame. The audacity, the sheer bloody audacity. "Will someone tell me why the engineering ministry never thought of that?" "It's certainly innovative, sir." "No shit." "It is indeed, Captain. Right." He settled on before clapping his hands, gaining the attention of the staff. They looked up from their consoles. The chatter faded. "The Prime Minister will be expecting a briefing soon, and I need some solid answers to take to her. I need initial estimates on what we're facing. Size, composition, quality, the works. Intelligence has dropped the ball, and you need to pick it up. Hop to it, people." The bustle resumed as if a switch had been flicked. Darrow gazed over the busy activity, his vision tracking past his troubled-looking staffer. "Sir," Martinez murmured.
"Yes, Captain?"
"The KEF was staging on Asteria."
"I know, Captain," Darrow whispered back. "I know. And we need to know what their status is quickly. They may be our wild card, or they may be the key to the Neo-Hegemony defeating us before we even get into this war."
Martinez blinked. His mouth opened and closed as if he had not even considered the prospect. Did he really think that this was just one of the kingdom's policing operations in its expansive dominion?
"War?"
Martinez finally swallowed, and Darrow could sympathize. War implied someone was going to shoot back, something the kingdom hadn't had to seriously face in over 2 decades.
"Yes, son. As of today, we are at war with the Neo-Galton hegemony."
Chapter 3. Captain Cutter. New Avalon Orbit. Starbase Victory. Each breath burned his throat harder than the one before. Hal Cutter increased his speed from a jog, through to a run, and then into a dead sprint. He followed the winding path, his trainers pounding on the flagstones as he powered through the lush greenery of the park, racing past the other early morning runners heading in the opposite direction. He didn't even take the time to give them the polite nod of greeting which signified companionship between fellow early-morning-running masochists. His arms pumped and his breath increased to a rasping grate. To his right, through the vast picture windows, the huge sapphire and emerald-colored globe of New Avalon loomed large, illuminated by the golden light of its parent star, Regis. 30 more seconds. Just 30 more. He refocused, his head dropping as the fatigue poisons infiltrated his muscles. Every step grew harder and harder, his legs turning to leaden weights. 20. He reached deep into his empty tanks, summoning the last erg of energy to see him through to his destination. He could see it now, the bench he had identified as his stopping point. The objective. He would get to it if it damn well killed him. 10 more seconds. A rasping groan escaped his lips. Made it. He decelerated rapidly, cantering to a halt, and with a heavy hand slapped the back of the bench.
Then he promptly bent over double, wheezing in a desperate attempt to get air into his tortured lungs. Lost Earth, this wasn't as easy as a few years ago. Back in the day, he'd think nothing of joining the Kingdom Marines on their brutal PT sessions. He'd even shown a few how it was done. Now, halfway between his 40th and 50th birthdays, he could barely bring himself to watch that particular brand of torture. Standing up, he pushed the palms of his hands into his back, arching it, and felt the welcoming release of his body stretching before slumping down onto the bench, his rasping pants reducing to normal breathing. Before Cutter, the huge windows overlooked a vast mooring spoke reaching out from the spinning wheel of Starbase Victory. Dozens of docking slips permeated its length, the vessels within exposed to the harsh vacuum of space. The docks got bigger further out, going from the small and nimble destroyers to the aggressive, sleek lines of the cruisers. And then finally there she was, his ship, Achilles, squatting alone in the battleship bays. Her lines were muscular, but to a seasoned spacer like Cutter, robust and lethal. Huge pulse cannon batteries studded her kilometer-long space frame, even partially hidden behind a lattice framework of loading equipment as she took on the supplies and ammunition, she exuded a thunderous power. A battleship was made for war, to take the fight to the enemy, and win. Cutter's breathing slowly faded to normality, his hands still resting on his thighs as he looked out over the ships of the largest space-going navy in the known galaxy. The Kingdom Navy, feared by her enemies, her battleships the largest, her destroyers the most numerous, her cruisers bringing the Kingdom's foreign policy into their rival space. They stretched through the Arcadian sector, across the empty reach, and even into the vast expanse of the Great Void, protecting and projecting the Kingdom's rule to the distant colonies. Cutter gave a bitter chuckle. Or they had. Oh, the Kingdom Navy still had the numbers. Not even the Federation, with its massive economic might, could match them in terms of raw tonnage or hulls. But most of the fleet was old now and frayed around the edges. Many of the ships had served in the Great War against the Galton Imperium of a quarter century ago. Achilles and her sister ships were among the only recent capital ship construction in years. The Admiralty was steeped in dogma and arrogance, unable and unwilling to accept that the galaxy had moved on, yet confident in their own superiority. And seemingly blind to how damn thin spread they were. The chart showing the Kingdom's territory wasn't a homogeneous mass like most, no every other star nation. It was isolated systems scattered throughout known space, separated by long weeks of travel time. No. Cutter let his clasped hands dangle between his spread thighs as his frustrations boiled over. He was making the right choice. He'd risen far and fast, a testament to his own frustrated ambitions and drive, but what he'd found here in the lofty position of captain of a battleship was that the glory days of the Kingdom belonged to the generation before. And now he had other reasons to get out, far more important ones. This would be his last cruise. Then he was home. For good. He stood and walked back along the meandering path toward the officers' quarters. "I'm home!" he bellowed as he came through the door. As soon as it slid shut, he peeled off his sweaty T-shirt and flung it into the hamper as he walked past the bathroom of their small apartment in officer country. "Morning to you, too," he grumbled when no response came. He made his way through the lounge where Iona sat on the settee, watching a bunch of talking-head news presenters frantically discussing something. Her face was a picture of rapt attention. He filtered it out as he entered the kitchen and plucked a glass from the cupboard and filled it with water. He'd catch up on the news when he caught the transit down the spoke. He tapped the kitchen counter holodisplay, display, and a menu of mail flickered into existence above. He swiped his hand through the headers. Bills, junk mail. A flyer for a nice-looking restaurant that looked like it had opened up on the circumference promenade. And, "Hey, looks like Sawtis finally got back to me, honey." He keyed it open and scrolled down the display with a flick of his finger, past the antiquated anchor crest of Sartis Shipping. "And they say my references have come through." If this panned out, the longest he would be gone from home would be days, not months. Still not ideal, but far better than what he had now. And the recompense would be a hell of a lot more than he saw now. "Honey?" he frowned, not hearing a response. He paced through to the lounge and saw what she was watching. Thoughts of Sardis Shipping disappeared from his mind as the footage on the news channel replaced the discussion panel. A world, Asteria, he recognized from the continents, flickered with explosions. Huge freighters hung in orbit, disgorging streams of landing craft. He saw the ticker band of breaking features scrolling across the bottom and listened to the commentary for the first time. Casualties are estimated to be in the thousands from thermonuclear detonations over military facilities at Nova Silaria. Aurelian Republic forces are reported to be falling back across all theaters and territories. Lost Earth? The Republic? We are still awaiting a statement in regards to our expeditionary force, which is stationed on Asteria, but it is likely they are engaging the hegemony forces. He walked around the couch and lowered himself next to his wife. She glanced across to him, her eyes wide. She reached out and gripped his hand tightly with hers and pressed against him. To repeat, the Republic has issued a formal declaration of war against the neo-hegemony, more as we have it. I think. Already a to-do list formed in his mind, and it was populating with a hell of a lot of items. I need to get to the office, honey.
I know,
Iona replied.
I know.
Might have to put the resignation plans on hold, too. She gave a tight nod.
I know that, too.
Standing, she pulled him up with both hands.
Go to work, Spacer. I need to get to the hospital. It looks like we may be getting busy soon.
Even here?
There's going to be refugees, Hal. They've got to come somewhere.
Okay. Cutter nodded. Lost Earth. In her state, dealing with a flood of people coming in from a war zone. He looked down at the bump of her belly. The primary reason why he wanted out of the Navy. And from what he could see, the primary reason he'd have to stay in, to defend his family. You do what you have to do, he settled on. But remember, you have someone else to look after, too.
I'm not likely to forget it, and neither should you.
His wife gave a thin, humorless smile.
Go. Get to work.
Chapter 4 Private Wink Goebel Asteria 100 kilometers east of Port Rorion. Private Patrick Wink Goebel sat, leaning against the rough bark of a tree, his legs drawn up and his elbows balanced on his knees. He pressed his mouth to the small tablet in his hands, yet he couldn't take his eyes off the lightning-like pulses of illumination punctuating the darkness, highlighting the copses of Terran transplanted willow trees sprinkled over the fields and cow-filled pastures before him. From the night sky above, fiery embers rained down. More and more of the invading gulls streaming down in an unending cascade. Another bright flash came from above. Something big going up. Perhaps another one of the orbital fortresses. Perhaps one of the Republic's last few ships fighting to defend this world. Who knew? Certainly not him, nor the other men and women gathered looking at the skies in fear. He pulled his head back from the tablet and squinted at the picture on the lock screen. A young woman held a baby. The most beautiful woman in the world as far as Wink was concerned, her face red and flush from the effort of delivery, yet cradling a newborn child to her breast. His wife, Lil, and the daughter he'd never met, Patricia.
Private?
I just want to go home soon. Lost Earth, please let me go back soon.
Wink's so-called because of his perpetual squint, thought. This wasn't supposed to be a war. Not a real one, anyway. Yet here he was. In the middle of a fucking invasion. A sudden surge of frustration filled him. He fought the urge to toss the tablet. It was the only private material he was allowed to carry on exercise. If it broke, then that was it. He'd have nothing showing Lil or Patricia.
Private!
Sergeant Loomis snapped. An intimidating silhouette loomed over Wink, but the hand he laid on Wink's shoulder told a different story as it gave a gentle, reassuring squeeze.
Son, rifle and admin.
Wink gave a start as the voice penetrated his consciousness, then nodded at the stern older man. Sergeant Loomis. Earth. Wink didn't even know his first name. Unless it was Sarge, which he doubted. Somehow he never figured he would be on first-name terms with a man.
We gonna...
Wink cleared his dry throat, then tried again.
We gonna have to fight, Sarge?
Loomis looked back to the east. The flashes of lights gave an eerie pulsing illumination to his face. He glanced up as a lone fighter thundered overhead, burning hard toward the battlefront. It disappeared into the battle-tortured night. Then, where its course would have taken it, an explosion blossomed in the sky, followed a few seconds later by a crack.
Yes, son, we're going to fight.
Loomis surveyed the other young men and women of the platoon.
You all are. The war started, kids. The war we all knew was coming, but somehow eluded the brass.
Wink felt his lips curling in a frown. Not everyone thought like that. He joined up because Lil's dad would only give his blessing if he had a good job and could look after his daughter. There was no way he was going to work in a factory or warehouse, doing jobs considered too menial.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?